But today, we turn to Brendan Sims, who is the author of Unfinest Hour, which was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson's Prize, Three Victories and a Defeat, Europe, the Struggle for Supremacy, and The Longest Afternoon. He's the Professor of History of European International Relations at the University of Cambridge and Director of the Forum on Geopolitics there, President of the Henry Jackson Society and President of the Project for Democratic Union. And what it doesn't say on his CV is that I rated him so highly that when I was Chief of the Defence Staff, I asked him to come and join my strategic advisory panel. So there. The title of his new book and the title of his lecture today is Britain's Europe, A Thousand Years of Conflict and Cooperation. Whether the conflict and cooperation went on at the same time or different times, it will be interesting to discover, and which particular phase of the cycle we're in now will be interesting to discover. But Brendan is going to speak to us, as is usual, for about 20-25 minutes, and then we'll go for questions and answers. So, Brendan, the floor is yours. We very much look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction and for this invitation, and for coming to listen to me. This is an unusual talk for me to be giving. I've been giving quite a few lectures. Can you all hear me? Oops, you can all hear me, can you? Shall I lift it?
They should just twist it.
Thank you. Okay. You can all hear me now. Perfect. So I've been giving quite a lot of talks, mainly at places like the Hay Festival and bookshops. So you're a rather more sophisticated audience, but I hope we'll have a good discussion. I should say at the outset that this book is not intended to tell you how to vote on the 23rd of June. I have my own views, they might emerge, but that's not the purpose of the book. It's intended to provide some deep historical background on Britain's relationship with mainland Europe over the past few hundred years. Now, it advances three propositions, which I think are central in understanding Britain's role in Europe. The first is that the European Union was designed to deal with the German question and the European problem, or if you prefer, the German problem and the European question. The two are actually two sides of the same coin, basically the same thing. The second proposition is that the European Union was not designed to deal with the British problem. By that I mean that nobody sits down after 1945 and says the United Kingdom has been such a threat to European peace that it needs to be embedded in some kind of international, larger structure of governance. Nor does anybody say the United Kingdom is so incapable of defending itself in the world that it requires protection of such a multinational or such a political union. But my third proposition is, notwithstanding that fact, is that Britain's principal framework, the principal driving force in English and later British history, and I'm going to say England and Britain fairly interchangeably. I'm Irish, I can do that, I know that we have Welsh people in the audience, but in geostrategic terms, it's actually a distinction without a difference, most of the time. So, I argue this is the driving force in British history, but that the answer to this problem, to this threat from Europe, is not the European Union, but the United Kingdom. So those are my three propositions. Let me now illustrate them briefly. First of all, that the European Union was designed to deal with the German question and the European problem. I understand this primarily in structural, not primarily in behavioural terms. We all know the history of the 20th century, when the German Reich on two occasions disrupted the peace of the continent. But the German question has been central to European history going back hundreds of years, and it's primarily a structural issue to do with the size of Germany, its central location, an area of contestation, the strength of its economy, its economic potential, its military potential, when realized, which either destabilizes Europe or in the hands of outside powers, destabilizes Europe. One way or the other, Germany is absolutely central. And after 1945, you have added to the German question the issue of Soviet expansionism and communism. So the European project that emerges, this is a crucial bit for my argument, is a project of double containment and of single or multi-mobilization. It's designed to contain Germany, as I've already said. It's also designed to contain the Soviet Union. And in order to contain the Soviet Union, it must not merely embed and contain Germany, but it must also mobilize Germany and indeed the other Western and Central European countries against the Soviet Union. That is the reason why we have the European Union that we have today. And Winston Churchill, as many of you will know, in September 1946, endorses that vision of European unification. It doesn't happen quite in the way that it's envisaged, largely because there's a hiving off of political and military integration with the failure of the European Defence Community in the 1950s and what then becomes the European Economic Community and later the European Union starts economically and then acquires more and more political characteristics. But it's still the case that everything we see today in terms of common European projects, particularly the Euro, single market, Schengen, and so on, these were all originally designed to deal with this question of double containment. And in the case of the Euro, even more recently, this is not ancient history. So when President Mitterrand, in the 1980s, is contemplating the strength of the Deutschmark, which he describes as Germany's nuclear weapon, he says we must decommission this nuclear weapon through the Euro. So a European currency to deal with Germany. Now we come to the role of Europe in British history. First of all, this is a question of the principal source of threat. That is how Europe is generally perceived in political terms. Europe, as Winston Churchill, who of course was a man of the empire, a man with enormous experience and knowledge of the global reach of the British Empire, nevertheless, in 1913, states very clearly, Europe is where the weather comes from. That's where the main threat to these islands will come from, always has and always will. And I think we need to understand the security of these islands in terms of ever-extending circles. So in the Middle Ages, it's essentially focused, or primarily focused, on the Channel. But the Channel shouldn't be conceived of primarily as a barrier. In the Middle Ages, as I'm sure you all know, the seas do not separate, they connect. You know, it's quicker to get from Calais to Dover than it is a comparable distance by foot within England. And so securing the north coast of France and the Low Countries, Channel ports, becomes an absolute commonplace in English grand strategy. The narrow sea. And then you have a phenomenon of the sink ports, which is not actually primarily a defensive service, but it's a ferry service. So it underlines the point that this is a connection between the south coast of England and the rest of Europe. And that remains the case. The importance of the Channel has come back again with the whole migrant crisis, and many of the same ports are now back in the frame in the discussion. Then the next circle is the Low Countries, which is present-day Belgium and Holland, which by the 18th century is conceived of as a barrier defended in the barrier fortresses by Dutch troops, but with the British essentially as the backstop. So keeping what is then the French enemy out of the Low Countries, absolutely central to British security. Then in the early 20th century, the principal reason why Britain joins in the First World War is again to defend the neutrality of Belgium, although of course the general phenomenon of German power is also very important. Then there's a wider circle. This is really where I've tried to make my own scholarly mark. The book was mentioned, Three Victories and a Defeat, which concentrated on the 18th century. And that talks about the way in which in the 18th century, British grand strategy is very much focused on what's happening in Germany in the Holy Roman Empire. It's a real sign of the political culture of the times that when Britons before 1760 speak of the empire, the crisis in the empire, they mean the Holy Roman Empire. They don't mean the British Empire. So that gives you a sense of their Eurocentricity, if you like. So defending the Holy Roman Empire was part of defending the Low Countries, which in turn is part of defending the south coast of England. So the argument always is, if Germany goes, then the Low Countries go, then they'll be in our own country. And finally, of course, you've got the overall European balance. which by the end of the 17th century has become something of a commonplace in English strategic thinking. So making sure that no single hegemon controls the power, has a dominant power in Europe. That I think you're all familiar with. What needs to be added here only is that these threats, these geopolitical threats, also acquire a very important ideological overlay, which interpenetrates with the strategic arguments. So in the course of the 16th century, you've got the Reformation. So what you have is an increasing sense in this country that the defense of Protestantism in Europe is a critical part of the defense of Protestantism here. Again, with geostrategic arguments. If Protestantism in Germany is defeated, the Dutch will be next, and we will be next after that. The same argument is then secularized by the late 17th, early 18th century, when in place of Protestantism, you increasingly hear reference to parliamentary liberties, to the defense of Parliament and its liberties against continental absolutism. And then the 19th century, it's defense of liberalism. And in the 20th century, you all know this, it's about the defense against tyranny, against Kaiserism, against Nazism, against communism. And so the argument about Europe then becomes a more extended security argument. It's not just about particular points on the map, though it also is. It's also about a general ideological commitment to one's fellow thinkers or like-minded people within Europe. If you want to defend Protestantism in England, you must defend Protestantism everywhere. You want to defend liberalism in England, liberalism everywhere. Democracy in England, democracy everywhere. You get the drift. So, but it's not only the content of policy, the nature of grand strategy, that is determined by Europe. In the book, I very strongly make the argument that actually British high politics, the ordinary run of politics, is very often fundamentally shaped by the European context. So, for example, in the 17th century, I argue, the original casus belli between Parliament and the King is really the question of whether to intervene in the 30 Years' War. James, because it starts with him, James I, really wants to pursue a more Spanish policy. He wishes to ally with the Habsburgs. He's got a mind, really, to some kind of alliance of Christendom against the Turks. Parliamentary critics say, you've got it all wrong. What's happening is that counter-reformation is on the march on the continent. And when they have crushed the German Protestants, they'll come for the Dutch, and then they'll come for us. And it's the failure, the perceived failure of the Stuart dynasty, first under James, then particularly under Charles, and then, of course, even later with regard to Louis XIV, under James II, the failure of the Stuart dynasty to get a handle, as critics see it, on English grand strategy, her interest in Europe, that really does in that dynasty. In the 18th century, we have a Europhile versus Eurosceptic debate, which is very similar to the one today, only much more scurrilous and vicious. Broadly speaking, I'm simplifying here, you've got Tories who are the Eurosceptics of the time. They believe in Britain having a maritime identity, a colonial destiny, a purpose to expand in the world. They see the continent as a source of corruption, politically particularly, and they see money spent on continental alliances as a complete waste and actually bad for the political culture of the nation. By contrast, the Whigs are continentalists. They say no. The defense of liberties in this country, the defense of the South Coast, depend on the maintenance of the European balance. Therefore, we should have an active policy in Europe, support European alliances, and so on. And that debate then continues. In the late 18th century with Edmund Burke, supporting intervention against the French Revolution, arguing that you can't have an ideologically inimical project like the French Revolution in your immediate neighbourhood. And he articulates, and I describe this in a chapter in the book, he articulates the doctrine of vicinity, which in today's language means neighbourhood. In other words, it's not simply a matter of allowing things to happen according to its own dynamic in Europe. You actually have to intervene to prevent your neighbour from erecting a dangerous nuisance. That's the exact phrase he uses, so that there's a direct interest in what happens. Likewise, in the Napoleonic period, when Prime Minister William Pitt the Younger is a supporter of intervention on the land in Europe, supporting coalitions, Secretary of War Henry Dundas is a supporter of a more colonial and maritime policy. The fact that Europe is absolutely central in the 20th century during appeasement, I don't need to tell you, you're all familiar with that, and a great many of you here will remember the discussions of the 1990s, and nobody can escape the fact that over the last few months we've been doing little else in British politics but talking about the European dimension. But the impact of Europe goes even deeper still, in a way that's not often realised. I'm a fairly poor medieval historian, but I'm told by those I trust that the formation of England in the period leading up to about 1000 was fundamentally driven by the threat of Viking raids. That was really, England was made, as it were, by that European context. But what I'm absolutely certain of, I studied this myself, is that the United Kingdom is a direct product of the European system. So when England and Scotland unite in 1707 in parliamentary union, not just in regnal union, it is in the context of the War of the Spanish Succession, the threat of Louis XIV's France as an ideological project of counter-Reformation Catholicism, of continental absolutism, as a territorial project of a direct military threat to these islands. And it's in that context, particularly from the vantage point of London, that the Act of Union is passed in 1707 and the United Kingdom is created. So as I say in the book, Europe made us. No European state system, no United Kingdom. The United Kingdom makes little sense originally outside of its European context. And I would almost add, it doesn't really make much sense currently outside its European context, and we can talk about that later if you like. And that creates then a structure which is pretty much unique and distinctive within Europe at the time, and I would say even remains so. A structure which has enabled this country to mobilise in a very comprehensive way the energies of all its subjects, citizens, if you prefer, and has created an actor in the world that, as Douglas Hurd, I don't always praise, but in this case got it right, an actor which punches above its weight in the world. But almost actually, its weight even is very substantial. And it still is. I argue in the penultimate chapter of my book that the United Kingdom is actually the last major European power in Europe, which is a major power. And so it could consequently, if it wanted to, leave, survive, and possibly even prosper outside of the European Union. So to sum up the historical part of the argument, on the continent, Europe and European instability was the problem, and the European Union was the answer. In Britain, Europe was also the problem, but the United Kingdom was the answer. And that is a very fundamental, very fundamentally different way of looking at European history and one's own history as between these islands, or this island, and the rest of Europe. That's a crucial distinction, which I want to emphasise. And I think it helps us to understand the current situation, just where I come to the present day. The European Union, certainly the Eurozone, is an incomplete union. It has federal aspirations. It has the aspirations of a single state, that is to say, a single currency, a common currency, a common travel zone, which would require a common border, and the aspiration towards a common foreign and security policy. But it has only given itself really confederal or intergovernmental instruments to sustain. So the absence of a proper treasury, joined up fiscal policy, lack of a secure border, lack of a single army to secure to sustain the foreign policy, and so on. And that's why we have the crisis we're in. That's why we have the euro crisis. That's why we have the migration crisis. That's why we have the crisis of European security, because if it were not for NATO, Europe would not be a credible actor, and it is struggling to contain Mr. Putin. Now, all of this is not, I think, a problem for the United Kingdom in the narrow sense. If the European project were to fail, the UK could, for the reasons I've given, defend itself. It could trade. It might very narrowly survive perfectly well. It might even do better in certain sectors. I don't know. But what is clear is that the weather still comes from Europe. Leaving the European Union will not change that fact. Strategically, economically, demographically, the United Kingdom will be profoundly affected by the future of the European project. And Brexit, clearly, and here I show my own cards, will make that worse. It will be a terrible blow to the confidence of the rest of Europe. It will probably encourage separatist tendencies in Europe or desire of other states to leave. I don't myself think that any other state will leave for the reasons that I've given, because they have nowhere else to go. But it's certainly not going to help. Let me turn briefly at the end towards the effect of Brexit, the two likely outcomes, and how they would relate to the European project more generally. I don't think Brexit, for the reasons I've given, will cause the UK to be adrift and irrelevant. That's the reason why I didn't sign the Chancellor of the Exchequer's letter, signed by the vast majority of my colleagues. So I thought that was a complete exaggeration and very much underplayed the innate strength of this country. The UK is a major power, and of course it will continue to coordinate European security through NATO. The European Union, by contrast, for all the reasons I've given, lacks coherence, and certainly doesn't have the organisation to punish the UK. There is a benign scenario. It could encourage further European integration, the shock. It might galvanise. But we've just heard Mr. Schäuble saying that won't happen. And more generally, it seems to me improbable that somehow European integration has been held up by the British. If that were the case, I would happily let them go. But let me turn then to the effect of Remain. That, in fact, in the long run, could be equally fatal to Europe. Because in the context of a Remain vote, there will be a massive temptation not to rock the boat, both in this country, where any talk of further mainland European integration will be avoided in order not to frighten the horses, and likewise, in mainland Europe, there will be an avoidance of talk about further measures because one doesn't want to restart the British debate. And that, I think, would be a terrible mistake, because all that a Remain vote on the 23rd of June will achieve for mainland Europe, and that's really what this is about. You're fine. They're not. All it will achieve for mainland Europe is a breathing space. All the issues I've described, and you're at least as familiar with as I am, will return after 23rd of June. They are at the moment in some form of suspended animation. It's been almost a conspiracy to keep them from the agenda. But they will come back. And if nobody has been talking much about the euro crisis, it's because other crises have been bigger in the last few years. Migration, Russia. They may all come together and explode at one point. I don't know. But in any case, the issues will return because Europe will not be stable. So there's only two ways of dealing with that. Either you settle it, you fail to settle it, in which case Europe comes back as a disaster zone, and that makes the Brexit breeze to blow for a second referendum. Or Europe integrates, becomes a superstate it must become, in my view, continental Europe, and that in turn will also make Brexit's breeze to blow. So we have the threat of a never-ending. So how do you deal with it? Well, my argument would be that the United Kingdom needs to break with the balance of power argument on the continent of Europe. It needs to embrace Churchill's vision of the Zurich speech, whose anniversary we have this year, support mainland European political integration in confederation with the UK, so that continental Europe would have its 1707 moment. And that leaves us, my two concluding thoughts, with a paradox. The paradox for Europhiles is that the best service they can render the European Union and themselves is to help to bring about a full Eurozone political union, of which the UK itself will not be a part. The paradox for the Brexiteers is that if they want to leave the European Union and do so safely, they must see mainland Europe sorted first. There is no safe Brexit without Euro exit. By that I mean there is no way of Britain leaving the European Union safely without the European Union in its continental part having united, which in effect means that the Eurozone would leave the European Union. So it wouldn't be Brexit as such, it would be Euro exit, which would, as it were, imply Brexit. And that constitutionally, psychologically, politically, is a completely different ballgame and a more benign one. So it's on those two thoughts, and I think still within my allotted time, that I leave you.